Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 180 for August 31st, 2011. Observium. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, bringing you weekly all sorts of interesting projects, the big projects, the little projects, and some other words that I normally put down in here, but I'm not going to say them exactly the same way every time. So making this stuff up as I go along. In fact, that should be the subtitle of the show, because that's what we do. But I always need a little bit of help when I'm making this show up as I go along, so I always have a really wonderful co-host. This week, it's no different. We have Dan Lynch. Dan Lynch, welcome back.
Hi, great to be here. Always happy to help you make stuff up.
Oh, yeah. Well, making stuff up is half the fun of being a host, is that we get to sort of be a little creative about how we interact with people and try to get them to be a bit creative about their answers. So it's a lot of fun going both ways. So we have a really great guest this week. We have Adam Armstrong. Make sure. Well, that one I actually could probably pronounce okay. Adam Armstrong, unlike a few of the next week's guests, is going to talk to us about Observium. Observium is a network management system, a network management tool that will go out and observe... Literally, not quite literally, I guess, observe the packets anyway that's flying back and forth from various devices on your network to see what your network health is, to see if there's things running correctly, just make sure that boxes are still up and talking to each other and stuff. And I know there's a lot of stuff in this place, so I know it seems a little bit like maybe it's like Nagios. We'll have to ask why it's not like Nagios, but because he says it's not exactly. And it sort of overlaps me with Cacti and stuff in terms of like drawing graphs on the screen. Again, a lot of players in this space. We'll have to have him sort out exactly how it all fits along with everything that's going on. We'll ask him also about the history of the project, as we usually do, and all sorts of stuff like that. So I have to say that as I'm preparing for this week's show, I didn't spend a lot of time looking at it because I kept thinking, okay, it's got to be something like what I already know, but we're just going to have to find out how it's different. Dan, was that your observation?
Yeah, pretty much. I've done a fair bit of stuff with Cacti back in the dark, distant past about 10 years ago, so I'm not exactly up to date, but I'd be interested to see how this relates to Cacti and some of the other things in this space, as you say.
Absolutely. Great. So before we get to him, though, we've got a couple quick shout outs. Just want to again thank Media Temple for hosting the podcast here in terms of actually having a place where I can record this, including giving me the giant mic that's to my left. My left. Yeah, you're right. No, my left. Well, my left. There's a mic somewhere on the screen, and that's the mic that they bought for me so I could do this show. God. All right. Oh, God, I'm going to have the giggles for this show already. I can already tell. But anyway, so I want to thank them for that. But more than that, more importantly than that, not more importantly, but as important, I also want to say that this show is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or PC or iPad. I do that on my Mac. Last night I was in my hotel watching the show. Watch a couple shows anyway. You can watch on your iPhone and some Android phones too. I have an iPhone, works just fine on that. If you have a gaming console, an Xbox 360, a PS3, or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. I have a PS3. It comes in beautiful 1080p on my PS3, the 3 days a month that I'm actually at home. Now, if you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV box or a Roku box. They're inexpensive and easy to use. I just got the new Roku, too. It does a full 1080p with Netflix. Looks beautiful. It's also very small. I actually brought it with me on this trip, hooked it up to the hotel TV, and I was actually watching Netflix on the flat-screen TV in my hotel room. Very, very cool. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any one of these devices, and you can begin watching a movie or show on one device, then finish on a different one. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. So try Netflix today for 30 days for free. Go to netflix.com/twit. That's netflix.com/TWIT. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial so that they know we sent them to you. No, they know we sent you to them. One of those. Okay. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Floss Weekly, and we hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Adam Armstrong. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
And where are we speaking? No, I got it backwards already. I did it right last week. I can't get it this week. Where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in a small town called Morpeth in the north of England.
Oh, my God.
30 miles south of the Scottish border.
Dan, where's that relative to you?
I would guess that's about, I don't know, 50, 100 miles maybe north of me. So it's not that far. It's cool. Yeah, just on the other coast, on the east coast from me. I'm in the northwest, that's the northeast.
Does he sound close by?
Reasonably. I haven't been to Morpeth, actually, so maybe I've missed out there, because I did some research today and I had a look. It looks like a beautiful place, and I should get up there sometime soon.
I've decided every Floss Weekly now has to begin with a travelogue, so...
Definitely.
But that's not why we're here to talk to you, Adam. I gave sort of a rough overview of the project, Observium, at the beginning of the show, but I probably didn't do it justice because it looks like there's a lot of moving parts here. So why don't you give us sort of the 30,000-foot high-level view, including like what problem it's trying to solve?
It's an ISP-focused network monitoring system. Most people, when you say that, they think of Cacti or Nagios, but we try to approach it from a different angle. We come from the standpoint of an operations engineer at an ISP or a telco who has a huge number of devices to look after. and one of the big problems you get in that environment is when you first set up the monitoring system. Say you have 100 devices, you spend 2-3 days adding them all to the system. Then over time, the network organically grows and you get more devices added. And then there's always that one device, usually the most important device that you've added in the last year, that someone's forgotten to add to the network monitoring system. So when that breaks, you might immediately know it's broken and fix it in the same amount of time you would have if it was in the monitoring system, but you don't have the historical data, which is quite important in working out why something misbehave, particularly if you're tracking DDoSes, to know when they happened in the past that maybe you didn't notice them. So we come from the standpoint of wanting everything to be automatically detected.
How are things automatically detected? I set up like Nagios, and I'm now setting up Zabbix for a couple of clients here, and does a device, when it comes online, start broadcasting packets to let people know it's there?
It's a lot easier in the networking world than it is in the systems world. In the networking world, we have protocols that allow two devices to recognize they're connected to each other. In Cisco, we have CDP. In the generic space, we have LLDP, where devices, they broadcast packets out of interfaces, and then the device that's connected to that interface can see that it's connected. So if you put Observium on one device, that device will expose via SNMP which are the devices it knows it's connected directly to, and often it will expose a management IP address, and then we can use that management IP address to detect that device.
Wow, so this is it's mostly automatic then. There's not like you have to sit there and go, yeah, I have this router and that's connected to this particular device, which then has send signals over to there. You don't have to deal with all that, huh?
Yeah, although having said that, at the moment, that mechanism is disabled because it doesn't work perfectly. That's one of the things we're hoping to re-enable soon. we've also got plans to auto-detect networks based on routing protocol information. Mm-hmm. So if you're running OSPF or RIP or BGP, that your devices will know about all the other devices in the network, and that should make it a lot easier because with CDP, you're spidering out. Whereas if you use a routing protocol, it already understands the entire topology of the network, so that should make it quicker.
Okay, so in order for me to want to use this, then I'm probably, you said like an ISP or maybe a network management stuff within a company, and I'm using this to identify devices or add monitoring devices. What kinds of devices are able to be monitored?
One of the other parts to the auto-configuration bit is that not only do we detect that devices exist, but we also detect what they are, what they're running, what software version they're running, what services are on them, and what needs to be monitored, interfaces and all that kind of thing. So in order for a device to be supported, we have to have written quite a lot of code. So we have to write a module for every SNMP MIB that we support, mm-hmm. and a little bit of code for every device so we can recognize it. At the moment, we do most networking stuff and most common Unix platforms, but we don't... I've actually forgotten what the question is now.
I have a better question, I think, that will help probably illuminate some of this. We've used the term SNMP a couple of times. I know a lot of our mod audience is not familiar with that. Can you kind of fill us in a little bit about what that's about?
That's Simple Network Management Protocol. It's a protocol that kind of comes from the telco end of the spectrum, which means it's a bit unusual when you first look at it. Lots of things from telco world are unusual when you first look at it. And it's a highly structured method of getting data out of network attached stations. So it's set out as a tree. It's difficult to explain. And you can pull devices and get information on interfaces, on processors, on what applications they're running. You can get lots of different information.
So it's sort of like the equivalent of XML for text. It's sort of really generic, and you can put a lot of stuff into it, but you really have to understand the layers and the tags to really make any sense out of it.
Yeah, and in fact, on the system side, a lot of places are starting to use XML as a statistics export mechanism rather than SNMP, because when you run a Unix host, it's difficult to plug into the SNMP daemon and feed information through it. So it's often a bit easier just to export that as XML, and lots of places do that. I believe, I might be wrong because I didn't write the code, but I believe we use XML when we import the VMware stats.
Ah, okay. So you mentioned SNMP, and you mentioned MIB. Do we cover that already, or is that something different?
A MIB is... in XML, you have kind of definition files. Is it DTDs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, DTD
which
schemas.
The structure. In SNMP, you have a MIB, which it defines a structure. A lot of people kind of misunderstand what they are and believe that if you put them into a system, the system automatically understands everything and monitors and detects everything. But it's more of a kind of a description of each element in the tree. The MIB will define what kind of element that is, whether it's an integer or text.
In terms of all its values.
Yeah. It does make when we first write the code, it makes it so much easier for when we do walks to have all of the data correctly formatted. But once we've written the code, we quite often ignore the MIB, particularly for numerical things, because when you load the MIB, it's a couple of fractions of a millisecond to load the MIB for every query. So we quite often don't bother loading the MIB and just take the data raw.
So, Adam, I'm curious to know what kind of system I can run this on. What kind of, we haven't really talked about the fact that it's all written in PHP and you're using MySQL and stuff like that. So does that mean I can host this on any machine that will run PHP and the requirements and so on?
As long as you can meet the requirements, it should run on pretty much anything. The difficulties are different versions of NetSNMP handle their command line arguments slightly differently. It was originally, the very first bit of development was done on FreeBSD, because the place I worked at the time was a FreeBSD shop. Then after that, it's all been on Ubuntu since, because the job after that was an Ubuntu shop, and then it was always too difficult to move. We do get a lot of support requests from people who've tried to run it on CentOS. And they're CentOS because it's so old. Even the current versions are so old. R&D tool is too old. That's the main problems we get, is when R&D tool is too old, because we have to be 1.4.3, I think, because we use a lot of the newer features.
Mm. Okay, well, that brings a nice segue into talking a little bit about RRD tool. Now, this is the thing that you use to draw all of the graphics and so on, the graphs, I should say, not graphics, in the display and so on. So can you tell us a little bit about why you chose to use RRD tool, maybe some of the advantages of it and so on?
It's a very simple question to answer. There are no alternatives. right. But having said that, RRD tool does what it does remarkably well. It has lots of features for dealing with the data. Basically, RRD tool, I'm not really a programmer or a developer. I'm a network engineer, so I might not explain this perfectly. It's a round robin database. So when you first create the database, it creates the entire file and it dumps data in. And it does it in a way that to write data, it does the minimum number of reads and writes, so it doesn't read and write too much of the file, and it never moves any of the data. It just overwrites data, and it has a pointer that points at the last one, so it always knows where it needs to write. It's incredibly quick to write to, which is very important for us, because we have a lot of scalability issues when you're dumping data to, say, 30, 40,000 RRDs every 5 minutes. Being able to write with, I think, is it one read and two writes to write an RRD file, which is pretty quick compared to a relational database, which is one of the alternatives. There's a complete package called RTG that writes everything to a database, and you can do a lot more things with it, but it's a lot slower. RRD tool is, they have a lot of quite interesting features that we don't use yet for prediction, which I want to use for disk space monitoring and that kind of thing. But it's kind of a unique bit of software that you probably wouldn't encounter unless you needed to store that kind of data that you didn't need to really get at the data again. You just need to visualize it. Because the data, once it's in there, it's quite difficult to get out. You have to convert it to XML and then feed it into something. But if you just want visual representations, then it's probably the best format around.
Excellent. And you mentioned about the read and write speed and so on. I would imagine scalability and so on. That must be quite a challenge, as you say, because networks can be, you know, almost exponentially big. And, you know, you're going to have a lot of information coming in. You've got to monitor all of these machines at one time. So how do you deal with things like scalability? As you say, could you cluster like instances of Observium, or do people do that kind of thing?
The very original development installation was actually three FreeBSD boxes. A box in the middle that had the storage, had the database, and had the front end, and two polling boxes that did polling. Back then, when I was doing the polling for every SNMP query I did, I loaded up all of the MIBs, and it took a lot of CPU time. About 2 years ago, I turned that off because I finally read the man pages for NetSNMP, and I started loading only the single MIB that we were using, and that dropped. I don't know if I still have the graphs anymore, but it dropped from, you know, maybe to about a third of the CPU load while polling, because every time we were starting SNMP, it was passing like 2 megabytes of MIBs, which was quite expensive when every SNMP query is only bringing back one value. So if I poll an interface, I'll need, I think, about 15 to 20 values for all the different stats that's monitored on that interface. And when I have a switch with 500 interfaces, you can imagine how that doesn't scale. And since we dropped that, I haven't had the need yet to move onto two devices. The only possible benefits I've had from moving onto multiple devices is to move the MySQL server off the same device that's that has the RRDs on, because the I/O load is just tremendously high. And I don't have a method yet for splitting the RRDs across multiple devices. If you were very clever, you could probably split the RIDs across multiple disks on one device, which might help. But it's the I/O load and the read-write. Because the writes are quite quick, but there are huge numbers of them, we generally scale by running multiple parallel instances. I tend to run about 8, because the latency between requesting the data from the server and getting the answer means that in that time, another 2 processors could have written their data while the first processor wasn't using the disk.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I've heard from a lot of people that that in these kind of setups, MySQL can be a bottleneck at times. So is it possible to... I know you said you're not actually much of a programmer, but is it possible to use another database if you wanted to, like, say, Postgres or something else to connect into that you were maybe more happy with or more familiar with?
Unfortunately, because I'm not a programmer, the Observium code is... I try to stay away from a level of complexity that means I can no longer maintain it. And I think if I started implementing other database layers, that might take it into the realm of it just being that little bit too difficult for me to add features quickly. It is something that gets asked rather a lot. A lot of people ask for PostgreSQL. And I did a year ago implement a database abstraction layer, which currently only does MySQL. It was just to get rid of SQL injection attacks, which someone on the IRC asked about earlier. We do have plans at some point maybe to add another database engine to it, as long as it doesn't make writing the queries we put into the abstraction layer more complicated.
Okay, yeah, well, that's totally understandable. I can see that, you know, you want to maintain the code and make sure that you're happy with it all. Maybe that's something that people could build on in future in some way in a community process or so on. So I'm curious, just to kind of back up a little bit, you mentioned right at the start when you were giving your introduction, you mentioned Cacti and Nagios as well. And I, many years ago, installed some Cacti instances for... when I was working at the NHS, we were asked to monitor the networks with Cacti at the time. This was about 10 years ago or something. So I know a little bit about that, but how would you compare and contrast what you do with Cacti and what's your kind of relationship there?
The difference between us and Cacti is we are a lot more focused. Cacti is very much a jack of all trades for graphing things. You can graph anything. You just have to either add it manually by knowing... what you want to pull, either the SNMP OIDs or running a small script to collect the information. You can do anything with Cacti, but it's very manual, it's very slow. To set it up and to maintain it, it's a nightmare. If you talk to anyone who has to maintain a reasonable size Cacti installation, it's a lot of work. The hatred for that amount of work is what drove me to write Observium. We can only graph and monitor things that we've already written a collector module for. So we're quite limited when it comes to corner cases. But we do everything, all the standard stuff. That's the main difference. We go for manageability, where you have an operations department that has to look after 2,000 switches. You don't need the flexibility, but you need it to be easily manageable.
And actually, that brings up a good point. You mentioned you were writing this after having maybe seen or tried to configure Cacti for this complex configuration. Can you go a little bit more into the history of how Observium came about and you know what motivated you and how you got other people involved to help you with some of the more detailed programming things?
Observium was originally inspired by a bit of software that had been written by a colleague at a company I worked at, seven or eight years ago now. And it was at a time when I was originally a sysadmin, very, very long time ago. And I got hired in a network position. And this bit of software I found incredibly useful because it understood the relationships between devices, how they were connected. And you could look at one device on a network and then click a link next to the interface and it would take you to the device that was that device was connected to. And it kind of gave a navigational understanding of the network and how it all felt, which is quite important when you're a network engineer. You have to kind of feel how the network works rather than,
And if this had been a television show, you would be doing that by going through some 3D flying interface where you'd be like pointing with a joystick interface down there. I just know it's so weird watching how people represent what we do as network admins and technologists. When it's on television, it's always got way too much 3D graphics. So I guess this wouldn't have that.
That's, you just kind of have to feel it rather than, you know, see it written down, if that makes sense. And after I left that job, I went on to another place. And I found it quite irritating because it was a new network and you have to go through that 3-week period where you have no idea where anything is or what anything's connected to, and you have to pick it all up. I found it quite irritating that that bit of software didn't exist. So I sat down and I wrote it incredibly badly in PHP. Just pulled a list of CDP neighbors and built a graph of the network. Then it started graphing interfaces and CPU. And it was quite useful. It was very difficult to add new things to, because as a not programmer, when you start something like that, you don't build the mechanisms to be able to make it bigger and pull something else and add another operating system, because originally it was Cisco and FreeBSD. Then when I moved to the next job, which was Cisco and Linux, I had to add Linux, which meant adding another layer for adding other operating systems. I've had kind of this history of writing a lot of code, then doing something else for 3 months and coming back and just being absolutely amazed I wrote that code, ripping the whole lot out and completely rewriting it. This was the first.
Wait! You keep saying you're not a programmer. I'm now going to say that is a being a programmer. You are. Really? You have just received your blessing. You are a programmer. That's what we do all the time.
And over time that happened quite a few times. I think 5 or 6 times I've ripped huge amounts of the code out and replaced it and tried to make it a bit more modular. I don't understand classful. That's not what I'm looking for.
Object-oriented programming? Yeah.
I was just about to say classful, networking term. So there's no object orientation, which a lot of people shout at me about, but I can't help it. I'm not a programmer.
You keep claiming that.
In 2008, for some reason, I'm not sure why, but my user base is primarily in Europe. Not a huge number in the UK, not a huge number in America, mostly in Europe, mostly the Dutch-speaking countries. And some Belgians started committing or submitting patches. And I gave 2 of them commit access after a couple of months. And they added a huge amount of new code and fixed a lot of my dodgy old code. And since then, there are 3 of us who take patches and fix problems and add new features. Generally, what gets added is what we personally need at the time, which is why I still, even now, I'm not entirely convinced that anyone else should be using it, because everyone who installs it, there's something small that they want that I never thought of. And it's kind of, we don't have a plan, any roadmap, which I think is also a bit unusual. maybe it's not.
What you do have already, though, what you do have is a good base for being able to do this kind of observation work. What you just don't have is customizations for the things that other people may encounter as they install it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And in a lot of instances, there are things that I want to write, but it's difficult to write them without an example of the hardware.
Sure.
You can actually see how the device returns data, because what the device returns and what's specified in the MIB often just have no relationship to each other, particularly when they're Generic MIBs, Cisco and Juniper, they have terrible history in implementing MIBs. Juniper particularly are terrible. Even in the Unix side, NetSNMP has very spotty implementation of things. Mm-hmm. So I might write the module that connects memory statistics on Linux. And then if you take it to NetBSD, it doesn't work because NetBSD doesn't split its memory up in the same way. Mm-hmm. And or the NetSNMP module doesn't expose those values in the same way. Sometimes you'll have situations where on one device, free memory will be free memory. So it'll be 128K all the time. And on another platform, it'll be free memory plus cached memory plus buffers. Whereas it'll also list those things separately and it can make quite a mess of the graphs. So having access to large amounts of different hardware and different operating systems is useful, but it's not something we have very often.
So you could say, though, that actually, you know, given that right now Observium is working for the kinds of products that you've encountered, that it's a workable product, it's workable, it's usable, you're using it yourself, and you could be inviting people to download it and add the things that they find missing for them.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the things I really hope happens as we go on and we add more stuff. I think we need to get to a critical mass point where we support enough of the things people want that they'll run it for that 3 days. That makes them not want to lose the things that we have that no one else has, and that may force them to add their own stuff to it. That's what happened to the Belgians. Once they'd been using it and they used the features they wanted, the things weren't there. They were forced to add them. It's just getting to the point where you've added enough of the small things that not everyone wants. I think we have a lot of them. It's just everyone has a little thing that they want that we don't do.
Yeah, that's probably it's a problem with any piece of open source software. It's like, I mean, that's what the blessing and the curse of open source is, that, you know, we can take the take what we've got and add to it if it doesn't fit what we have. But it's luckily, since you have this under an open source license, people can contribute that back and also take it and modify it and do what they need to with it, right?
Yeah, I'm no great lover of the GPL. We are we're GPL because some of the other code we used is GPL, and I think it makes releasing a whole lot easier if we use GPL for releasing. But our code is BSD licensed. We were originally BSD licensed, but I changed the release license. So we're actually even a lot more open than the public license suggests.
Okay. Actually, you know, I'm sort of curious. Since I also started, well, let's see, one of my first jobs was as a sysadmin. I've had so many jobs, so many hats, it's hard to keep that straight. How did you get into being a sysadmin? What was your history before that?
I was one of those kids who didn't really leave the house very much, I think. In my industry, that seems to be the route for getting into this kind of thing. I got a ZX Spectrum when I was 6. Mm-hmm. And just machine after machine after machine. I did have a period in the middle, I think a lot of people, where I discovered games rather than creating things. The Amiga period, I think, from the ZX Spectrum, the Commodore 64, and the Amstrad, was all creating things because it had BASIC and it was dead easy. You turned it on, you had BASIC. Once you got to the Amiga, you turned it on, you had nothing until you put a disk in. The disk was always a game, so you never created anything. And it wasn't until I went back to the PC. I also had an Acorn, which is a machine that any American viewers won't recognize. I created a bit on there, but it was when I got to the PC and discovered Linux that made it a lot easier to start creating things.
Mm-hmm. Did you find any particular framework on the Linux that helped you to create things better?
Not really. I know I should have used a framework when building Observium. But I think I tend to have this issue with barrier to entry. Mm-hmm. So learning a framework is quite a hump to get over.
Yes.
Before you start creating. And I found it simpler when I was originally starting the project just to sit down and write the 30 lines to grab the CDP table and dump it into a database than to build a framework, that, or to, than to build it on top of a framework.
And did you gravitate towards PHP immediately, or did you go through some other languages before you got there?
When I was six, I learned BASIC on the ZX Spectrum. Okay. And I wrote a lot of things that, in hindsight, looked pretty terrible. At college, I did Pascal. When I was a kid, when I was 10 or 12, I did have books on machine code assembly, but I never really did it. I really regret not doing that now, because it probably would have been a lot easier to pick up back then. I've never done C. I've looked at Java and been disgusted. I've spent a long time believing I should learn Perl.
Okay, but wait. Just back to the Java for a second, and we'll come back to that Perl point. But the fact that you're disgusted at Java, again, you're a programmer.
Really?
You're still getting blessed as a programmer.
Java just looks overly complicated for getting anything done.
It is.
The reason I like PHP is as someone who'd never read PHP, I could look at PHP and work out what it did. If I look at Java, I just can't work out what it did. And same with C, it's difficult. It's very, you know, abstract. I know this should have been written in Perl.
I don't think so. I'm not complaining at all, actually. I think for what you're doing right here, because what you really wanted to do is get immediate access to putting things into a HTML web page, I actually think PHP is probably the right language for this at the level of the people who are also maintaining it too. So, I think it's a proper choice. You don't have to sack up to me with Perl. It's fine. You know, Perl's for much different applications. It's no problem.
But it's most of the other applications that do this are written generally in Perl, except for Cacti, which is written in PHP. Well, I'm not sure why Cacti is written in PHP. I'd be interested to know. But it's just Perl was too difficult to get into. At the time when I was starting, it was either do it in PHP, which I'd written some little applications in before, learn Perl or learn Python. Python at that point was the cool language to be learning and doing this kind of thing in, which then flipped to Ruby, and I'm not sure what it is now. Ruby, I think, has kind of fallen out of grace. It's a fashionable thing.
Yes. It doesn't seem to have any sense.
I'm surprised how much of this stuff is actually kind of based on fashion or the newest thing. I'm just too slow moving to keep up with the newest thing.
And again, there's another programmer blessing there. You are definitely a programmer. You're hitting all the right points of everything we complain about. You're a programmer. Don't be saying you're not. Not a problem at all. Hey, so we've been chatting about Dan, did you have a question?
I had a couple of questions, actually. Okay. To kind of back up a bit, you've been having quite an interesting kind of general discussion on programming there, and I noticed you mentioned Linux a couple of times there, Adam. So what distributions have you used, and what do you like? You mentioned Ubuntu before. Is that your main kind of focus on the Linux side of things?
It is now. When I originally started, it was a release of Slackware that I got in a book, which was very, very long time ago, about 1995, 1996. And it barely worked on the hardware that we had, but kind of just fiddled around, you know, because it's new and it's fancy, and as a geeky kid, that kind of stuff's fun. After many, many years of trying to find it useful, I don't know how. I think a lot of Linux people spent a long time trying to find it useful before it actually came useful. Trying to use FEWM95 and believing that it was good. And after, I don't know when, it may be about 2000, I started a small hosting ISP using Linux as the hosting platform. Using Mandrake and OpenBSD. And I was a Slackware person until, I guess, 98. Then I moved on to Red Hat. I think it was about Red Hat 5 or 4.2 at that point. Then when Mandrake came out, because that was slightly shinier. It's all about things being slightly shinier. I moved to Mandrake. and then I was a Mandrake person until 2004, I guess. And one of my friends gave me a RackMan server to put into a rack at work when I was my first networking job. And it was Debian. And I was too lazy to reinstall it. So I just used it as he supplied it. And I decided I really liked Debian. And after that, everything I installed was Debian. And then when Ubuntu started to become fashionable, because it was slightly more shiny, I defected to Ubuntu, which is where I am now, because nothing more shiny has come along yet.
Yeah. So when they bring out a new shiny version of, I don't know, Fedora or something, then you might switch to that.
Oh, I don't think I could go back to the Red Hat stuff. I get too many. My only exposure to anything Red Hat produced these days is people asking for help on it with Observium. And it's always the same issues with slightly missing fonts or really old versions of things. It puts me off.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that you mentioned CentOS when we talked at the start about what distributions you can host Observium on. I think a lot of it's to do with the fact that they have like this long support periods, and a lot of them, they're built for enterprise, and a lot of people want to leave a server in the corner and not touch it for 5 years. That seems to be, if you want to do that, then Red Hat stuff's really great for that. Yeah, interesting to hear you say about Debian, though. So you ran a hosting company, you were saying, with Mandrake, which seems like a strange choice for a server OS, because I always thought Mandrake was a desktop OS, really, you know, more than a server. I suppose it's just Linux. But so you were running it on a server?
Yeah, it was running on servers, because it's basically just Red Hat. And most of the hosting software we were using was compiled at that point, because I also thought that was shiny at the time, compiling everything from scratch, which I've since decided is way too much effort. I had a brief flirtation with the Gen 2 thing, but I decided that was way too much work. I think as I've gotten older, I've become kind of allergic to effort, which is one of the reasons Observium exists. We put effort into Observium because it's fun, in order to not have to put effort into managing the network, because that's not fun.
Yeah, that makes sense. Obviously, as you say, I think that's a position that a lot of people take. People keep saying to me, since we're talking about Linux, people kept saying, if you used to be a Slackware guy, you might appreciate this. People used to say to me how great Slackware was, and when I tried to install it, I found that there's quite a lot of work involved in installing it. but then I realized the reason it's actually called Slackware is not because it's easy to install. It's because once it's installed, you can just leave it and it will run, which kind of seems like the same approach as you're saying, build the thing right in the first place and then you don't have to keep going back and fixing it all the time.
Yeah, I think it's a sysadmin, netadmin kind of frame of mind. The obsessive automation of anything that can be automated. The add user scripts on Unix devices are quite good examples of that. You have the executable for adding the user, or you have the little wrapper script that does it all for you. Originally there was just the binary, but then someone decided that was way too much effort to do it that way and create the home directories and all that stuff, and then wrote the wrapper. Same, we always, when you're upgrading network devices, if you have to add a new IP address to the firewall on all the network devices, better to use a little script to do it. So you don't write a little script. You write like a little script for producing a script, so that you don't have to rewrite the script every time. And it's a tiny bit more effort now, just to save you all that time later on.
Okay, cool. And since we kind of talked a little bit about deployment there, I'm curious to know, I think I kind of asked you this before, but what's your kind of typical user for Observium? You know, what's their kind of typical deployment, do you think?
Despite what our focus is, that we're focused on ISP and telco deployments, we don't actually have a typical user. Loads of people that I would never have guessed to use it. We have people running it to monitor single servers because it has a nice interface and it's very clicky and it's all automatic. And we have people who monitor large hosting deployments, who monitor cloud hosting companies. One of the Belgian guys is monitoring a large cloud hosting platform with the virtualization monitoring he wrote. We have people who monitor wireless networks, people who monitor small ISPs or little home family networks so they can monitor all of their aunts and uncles, routers and that kind of thing. You know, people who do support so they can monitor this kind of stuff. We have a very broad user base. I find it quite surprising.
Hmm. And you mentioned that you're using Ubuntu Linux and so on. So are you packaged in Ubuntu? Do you package it yourself, or is there anybody out there packaging Observium for you so I could maybe install Ubuntu and then go and apt-get Observium? Is that possible at this point?
We have an upgrade mechanism in the software that relies on SVN. So you run an SVN up, and then when you run the discovery script after that, it automatically updates the database with anything that's changed based on the SVN revision. And we try to keep the SVN head revision so that it works, so that there's nothing broken about it. So we've tried to stay away from even numbered releases now. So we don't have a package because we like people to keep updated with the very same version that we're using. I don't know if that's bad practice, but we found when we had the numbered releases, people never ever updated anything. And we were getting support requests from two-year-old releases with 1,000 things that were already fixed. And because we fix things quite quickly and we do get a lot of little bugs being the kind of software that we are, we find it more useful to track the versions that we're using exactly.
Well, that is one way to make sure they stay up to date, is if you have some automated self-healing stuff in there to pull down the latest release from your SVN archive. Why are you using SVN and not something more modern like Git? Or is it just legacy?
Because when I started, I think there was some revisions that were very originally in CSV.
CSV too, we don't know.
I found it really complicated to use. So I switched to SVN. I think this was in about 2007. And I never really understood SVN. I still don't understand SVN beyond committing things and downloading it. I don't really understand it, which is the reason we haven't moved to Git, because we have this auto-update mechanism, and I don't know how to move all of the code across to Git and retain the auto-update mechanism and whether it would still work. I get a lot of very angry people coming and demanding that I use Git just because people that don't even commit, they don't contribute. They just want to be checking out the code using Git, and people are really, really attached to Git.
Welcome to the programmer world once again. I now can bless you on a couple of other things that you don't totally understand SVN. That proves you're a programmer. And it gets even more complex, but people want it. That's also the programming world. So, again, I now have 10 pieces of evidence that says you got to stop saying you're not a programmer. So we've chatted a bit about Observium. Is there any last things that we left out that you'd like to discuss before we have to let you go?
Well, if there's anyone who is using or tries to use the software, but isn't a programmer, even less of a programmer than I am, one of the things that we quite like to get, but that no one's actually really done, is any suggestions for how the interface should look. Because I'm quite obsessive about the aesthetics of the interface. And there are some sections of it that I'm not quite sure how to lay out so it looks good. A lot of the other network management applications are kind of ugly, and we try to be pretty. If anyone has any suggestions just to sketch out how they think it would look, that would be incredibly helpful for me. more helpful than code, really.
So you're looking more for web designer qualified people rather than web developers.
Yeah, people who are good at design and people who have ideas on how to present information, because we're collecting the information is easy, dead easy. Presenting it in a way that's easy to understand, which is where the project comes from. That's the very beginning of the project. That's something we'd like more of.
Very good. And, of course, you wouldn't turn away people offering patches to talk to other devices that you don't have currently in the system, right?
Oh, no, no.
Okay, and how do they reach you? They go to your site, observium.org, I believe?
Yeah. On observium.org, there's links to... We have an IRC channel on Freenode. It's called Freenode now, isn't it? Yeah. We have a mailing list, a developer's mailing list. We have my email address.
Yeah. What site... You mentioned you knew of a number of places that were using this. Do you have any sense of like how many downloads you've had or how many people are constantly updating their installation?
I did have, when people did the update, it would submit the version they were running, but I haven't looked at that data. I should have looked at that data this morning, so I can't say off the top of my head. I believe when I looked at one point, there'd be maybe 20, 30,000 downloads in the last year.
Significant.
Which seems quite high to me. I think a huge number of people download it and then go, oh my God, it didn't work at my first attempt. I give up. Because it can be a tiny bit difficult to make work because it's not as polished as the installation method. There's no the web-based click thing where you click and you put in the automatic setup procedure. We don't have one of those yet, which I think is quite a barrier for some people.
Yeah, no lazy installation for people who don't want to read some instructions. But that's okay, because people can read instructions if they really need to do this. Well, I want to thank you for coming on today and talking about Observium and sharing in this project that's been a passion of yours for a while. And it sounds like the call to action here is if people can do better web design for you, help you out with that, and maybe help Observium talk to new projects or new piece of hardware, or maybe even be ported to new operating systems, that would be really cool. And I just want to thank you for coming on today.
It's fine. Thanks for having me.
All right, Adam. That's great. That was Adam Armstrong, who is the project leader and chief guy in charge of the Observium project. So, Dan, what'd you think?
Yeah, interesting stuff. I think, as we kind of discussed a little bit before the show, network monitoring is a very kind of interesting space. And it's a very complicated space at the moment, which is why I wanted to ask about Cacti and some of the other things. I hear a lot about Nagios. People are always telling me about Nagios and how great it is. But it sounds like Observium could do a really great job, and it's very focused as well. I think it's an interesting approach for them to, rather than try and be everything to everyone, you know, try and take the old Unix approach of doing one thing and doing it really well. I think that's quite a good approach for this kind of tool.
Yeah, and it's, I like the idea that, the one thing that's interesting is that, as we get these bigger networks, bigger deploys, we really have to automate more and more of it and have better dashboards. I mean, here at Media Temple, I see they have these big machines with all these graphs going by, and you really need that when you're doing a lot of traffic and you have many, many machines to monitor, and I can see that at a telco or an ISP needing to have some way of just observing that. And although I was kind of joking earlier about the 3D fly-throughs, you do need that level of graphics. You need that sort of like immediate sort of look at it at a glance and have a sense that things are mostly going along okay, and maybe we got a couple of bad clusters or something over here, but you need that sort of like immediate response to it. So I'm glad that everybody sort of takes a look at that. I was thinking as he was asking for web designers, I go, that's the opposite of me. I mean, if you go to my website, you know how bad my web design skills are. It's like the Shoemaker's Children, though. I've always helped other people out with their websites, and they still can't keep getting back to mine. That sounds like something like that anyway. I also like the comment, that I said, when he said he comes back to his code 3 months later and doesn't recognize it. And that was obviously proof to me that he was a programmer, because that's what we do. The act of programming is such a creative and immersive act that it's like once you're done doing that, you're done with it. You kind of just go, that's the thing there now. And then you have to focus on the next piece of code and do the same thing immersive there. So you tend to like lose this stuff out of short-term memory. And we used to joke about this. I still joke about this in the Perl class that I teach, that part of what you want to do is write code such that it can be understood by the person 3 months from now that has to look at it. And I said, more often than not, that person 3 months from now is you again, not being able to remember what you were thinking the previous time you wrote the code.
Mm, yeah, definitely. I think anybody who's ever written a program of any significant length has been in that situation. This is where you get into documentation as well. I mean, as programmers, and I'm not a programmer on your level, Randall, but as programmers, we don't kind of document because that's not as fun as writing code. You know, you don't document and comment as you should, but often you're the one who suffers later on when you haven't documented what you were actually doing. And that happens quite a lot.
Absolutely. And like I said, that's happened to me so many times, more so with stuff that's more like 3 or 4 years old. I tend to kind of know what I did 3 months ago. But even then, you know, I context shift so often because I have multiple clients and I have multiple locations I'm working from. And I've got my own stuff that I'm working on. I've got maybe 3 or 4 different projects I'm working on for each of my clients otherwise. And you come back to a piece of code and you go, what the heck was I thinking here? What was that doing? So I can completely relate, definitely relate. Anything else on Observium?
No. Obviously, as you said, if people, any web designers out there who are better at web design than probably either you or I, they should get in touch with Adam and see if he can help out. Because sounds like, they could use a little help on that. And that's the spirit of open source.
Great. Well, that's glad you've gotten him on finally. I think we've been actually working on him for about a year, trying to get him on the place here. Speaking of people on the show, that was almost a sensible transition. We have next week, we've got Tomas Meraz. It's probably mispronounced horribly, but talking to us about LiveCloud, which is a virtualization platform management library. I think that's actually even in use here at Media Temple, in some places anyway. Chris Moore after that about PCBSD, which is the graphical installer and sort of desktop-biased version of FreeBSD. So you take FreeBSD by itself sort of out of the box is sort of a server installation, and a PCBSD kind of makes it all friendly for the desktop. So it's a very nice setup. Chris Moore is one of the project leads there. Jonathan Ellis talks about Cassandra, which is the big key value store. You might call it NoSQL stuff. Originally, I think from Facebook. I might be wrong on that. I think that's Facebook's thing. And then I donated to the Apache project. So it's one of the main sort of key value stores people tend to use. I have just opened up Q4 scheduling. I have a bunch of open slots that will be filled. I've sent out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 pieces of email to try to fill the 13 slots. So I'm waiting for those to start coming back in. We've got some really interesting projects coming up. I guess I can hint that we're going to be doing a show about Bitcoin. Everybody in the world talks about Bitcoin, so Floss Weekly has to talk about it too. So we'll be having those guys on. And open source of the New York Times, Chef, Eucalyptus, Tmux, MariaDB. That's going to have Monty and Kurt von Fink on that, so it'll be really fun. A bunch of stuff on the shortlist. They're not confirmed yet, so I hope I don't give away anybody that isn't actually there. But if you want to look at that list, go to twit.tv/floss, which redirects you to a new, much harder to remember URL, but that URL still works, so I'm going to keep giving it out. And from there, you'll see the spreadsheet that shows you exactly who is coming up, and also all the ones we're looking at in terms of future guests as well. And if you have a project that needs to be on that list, have the project leader email me. That's the fastest way to get them to the top of the list, and I will focus on them on my next scheduling round, which won't be for another couple months or so. What else have I got here? So to find out when we've got new guests coming up, you can follow the Floss Weekly, all one word, Floss Weekly, Identica, or Twitter handles. And as soon as I get a new guest booked, or I try to tweet that right away, and or as soon as I get whoever the guest is coming up this week, I also try to tweet that. And I even sometimes send out invites about 90 minutes ahead of time. You can follow me, Merlyn, MARLYN, on Twitter or Identica. Although, actually, I don't think I actually post anything to Identica. So follow me on Twitter. It's much easier because then you'll actually see something. You can also follow me as Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus if you happen to have an account there. If you don't, I still have invites available. It keeps saying 150 left every time I send out one. So I guess I'm really infinite. 150 means infinite for me. So I think I must have done about 45 or 50 invites in the last week. So I've been getting about 1 an hour, like all day, all night. It's fine, guys. I don't mind. Please, if you still need Google Plus, let me know. You do need to send a gmail.com address. It has to be end in gmail.com or it won't work. Let's see. I think that's there. Oh, so if you are following me on Twitter, you would also know where I'm going to be this weekend, which is Dragon Con. I'm going to be in Atlanta, Georgia,
I'll have some spare time. So if you tweet me, I will pick that up. I look at everybody that uses at Merlin in a tweet towards my direction. And I should have a little bit of spare time. I'm teaching Hacker 101. I'm on the Hacker 101 panel, Hacker 201 panel. And I'm giving Lessons Learned from Flossing Weekly on the EFF track there at DragonCon. And I'm going to get to meet a whole bunch of cool people, including my friends Will Wheaton and his crew, which will be a lot of fun, again, to see those guys. I'll be in Vancouver, B.C. on September 8th in the evening. We're starting a cruise the next day from there. So I have, I'll be having some sort of like early party, but then I'll be looking for where else to do that night. So if you're in the Vancouver, B.C. area, try to send me some email. I'll probably be able to pick up my email when I at least can find a Wi-Fi connection. On September 14th, while I'm on that cruise, I'll be overnighting in San Francisco, and we're getting a bunch of us together to go to the Mint Karaoke Club in downtown San Francisco so I can do some karaoke and hang out with people like Fun Crunch. I think she's still in the chat room here. Speaking of the chat room, by the way, we do have a live chat room if you want to ask questions of our guests. If you go to live.twit.tv during our taping time, which is 9:30 a.m. on Wednesday mornings Pacific time, 12:30 Eastern time, and sometime a little bit later in the UK. And we'll go look it up. Let's just do the translation. Somebody's going to do the translation for you. Dan, I was also on this other show you have. What's the name of the show, and how can we find that video?
Floss Weekly. I knew you said there. My head, my brain's fried. No, that's this show, isn't it? right, let's try this again. Linux Outlaws is the show I think you're referencing.
Yes.
Yeah, we did a video interview last week, in fact, and the audio isn't actually out yet, but the full uncut kind of unexpurgated video is available now. If you go to sixgun.org, it's /Linux Outlaws. It's at Six Gun Productions with all our other shows. So if you you can Google Linux Outlaws, or you can still go to linuxoutlaws.com. That redirects you to the new address. There seems to be a lot of moving addresses going on lately with Floss and everything else. Mm-hmm. So you can find that there. And there's a full, I think it's an hour and something long video of you, myself, and my co-host Fab chatting away. All with, you can't actually see me. So that's a bit of an improvement. You can't actually see me because my camera wasn't working that day. So I just sound like a disembodied voice. But Randall did wear a very fetching black hat for us, which was very outlaw, which we appreciated. So you can find all that there if you just look for Linux Outlaws online or go to linuxoutlaws.com. The links will be in there. And we also have some other shows coming up. Obviously, we've got a regular kind of news roundup from the open source world. And we talk about not just Linux, but also other things as well. So mobile stuff, Android, all that kind of thing. So we're going to have that on there. So that's all coming up. I think there's 3 shows waiting to go out at the moment. So we've got more content than we know what to do with at the moment. So go and check that out. And also, when I'm not doing that, I also do a music show. So if you're into music, and particularly independent music and Creative Commons and artists kind of doing this thing for themselves, then check out ratholeradio.org. That's rat, it's a strange name, ratholeradio.org. And you'll find on there, there's a fortnightly show that I do, which is about an hour every fortnight. And we have a great selection of music. I also play live as well sometimes when people request. I do songs and things. So if you want to hear my embarrassing girly singing voice, then you can go and check that out. While I'm here, check out my own website as well, which is danlynch.org. And on there, you'll find a link to my blog where I regularly update every week about what I've been up to and what's going on in my kind of little world and so on. And you can also find more music and stuff on there. And you'll find all the links to Twitter, Identica, I've got to remember them all now, Google+, Facebook, all these things. So if you want to search for me on there, I'm pleased to see that somebody else had the same problem with, not problem, but the same thing with Google+ that I've had, because we had this discussion on Linux Outlaws, and every time I've sent hundreds of invites, but it never goes down. The 150 counter never goes down. Apparently for other people it does. So maybe it's just you and me, Randall. We have some kind of special unlimited invite privilege. I don't know. I'm wondering if there's a bit somewhere in the database that's been flipped to, you know, true rather than false or something that gives us unlimited invites. So yeah, go and check out danlynch.org as well, and you can find all the links there.
Very good, very good. And by the way, that hat I was wearing, I think I even said that in the show, but that hat I was wearing was in fact an authentic cowboy hat that I bought because I owned a bar in Eastern Oregon for a while, and I actually spent time getting decked out appropriately. Eastern Oregon's a cowboy town, basically. So I actually had the real official hat. I think I must have paid like $250 for that hat. It was an expensive hat.
Wow.
And I had all the official shirt. I even had a belt buckle that had the word Oregon on it. I mean, it was like just in the right boots and the right Wrangler jeans.
jeans, the whole thing. I had like the whole outfit from top to bottom. And so, see,
did you have spurs? Did you get any spurs at all? Did you get spurs at all?
No spurs. No spurs. No.
No spurs.
That would make it hard to drive my Z28, so that wasn't going to work out. Yeah. So that wasn't authentic. And I in the process of getting ready to move, I was boxing everything up, and I found that hat, and I had it cleaned, actually, because it was so covered in dust from 15 years of just sitting on the shelf. So I paid like $50 to clean the hat just to make it clean again. So I had to wear it every once in a while just to make sure that I got the value out of that. Well, I think I'm wasting everybody's time a little bit too much. Actually, not. This is an interesting story, I think. Well, at least three of you out there, it's probably pretty interesting. But I just want to thank you, Dan, again for being the co-host and pulling in a lot of Linux knowledge that I don't have.
No problem. Always a pleasure to be here.
Very good. And, of course, check out Dan's shows that he just listed. Always happy to have somebody out there doing a news show so I don't have to do all that stuff. Very cool. A lot more research than I'm going to put into it. So, I seem to be hearing the music coming up behind me, so you know what that means. It's time for me to say goodbye. So I'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.